From the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, this is Democracy Now! War, peace, and the presidency. We're breaking with convention.
They understand that we can secure our borders without tearing kids away from their parents.
Immigration is one of the biggest issues of the 2024 race and has been a hot topic at both the Democratic and Republican conventions. We'll host a roundtable discussion. But first, Israel's war on Gaza has been mentioned only in passing on the main stage at the DNC.
Surge humanitarian help and food assistance into Gaza now. And the civilian suffering of the Palestinian people. And finally deliver a ceasefire and end this war.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken ended his ninth visit to the Middle East since October without securing any breakthrough for a ceasefire deal. We'll get the latest. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. We're breaking with convention. I'm Amy Goodman. In Chicago, night two of the Democratic National Convention centered around Kamala Harris's sweeping economic proposals, which includes addressing the housing crisis, canceling medical debt, and banning grocery price gouging. Democrats held a ceremonial roll call to nominate Kamala Harris as president and Governor Walz as vice president. She accepted the nomination virtually in Milwaukee, where she and Walz addressed a packed arena, the same site where the RNC was held last month. The second night of the DNC in Chicago was headlined by former First Lady Michelle Obama and former President Barack Obama.
We do not need four more years of bluster and bumbling and chaos. We have seen that movie before, and we all know that the sequel is usually worse. America's ready for a new chapter. America's ready for a better story. We are ready for a President Kamala Harris.
Other speakers at the DNC last night included Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who called for expanding health care access and raising the minimum wage. He also addressed Israel's war on Gaza.
We must end this horrific war in Gaza. Bring home the hostages and demand an immediate ceasefire.
During Obama's speech, Jody Evans, co-founder of the anti-war group Code Pink, unfurled a pink banner inside the DNC that read, Free, Free Palestine. She was then escorted out. An array of anti-Trump Republicans also took to the stage last night to plead their case for Kamala Harris, including former Trump White House press secretary Stephanie Grisham. In more news from Chicago, protests continued for a third day inside and outside the DNC. On Tuesday, Code Pink and other pro-Palestine groups disrupted Minnesota governor and Democratic VP nominee Tim Walz during a women's caucus meeting. Meanwhile, several people were arrested Tuesday night outside the Israeli consulate in Chicago as police clashed with dozens of protesters demanding an end to Israel's war on Gaza. The Chicago Tribune reported at least two independent journalists were among those arrested. In other news from the DNC, American doctors who treated patients in Gaza held a news conference Tuesday to shine a light on the ongoing atrocities inflicted by Israel's U.S.-backed war. This is pediatrician Dr. Ahmed Youssef.
She had burns that covered over 70% of her surface area. which is a death sentence in an environment where you can't find gauze and there isn't clean water and there aren't antibiotics. We all knew what this meant on the ground in the trauma bay the first minutes we met her. She was gonna die there and her baby would die there. And there was nothing we were gonna be able to do about it because the Israeli government and the IDF had made it impossible to care for people to the extent which they deserve. Every human being deserves the right to medical aid in that situation. She was no fighter. She was a pregnant woman who was sitting in her home when a bomb dropped on her head.
Over 50 Palestinians have been killed over the past day as Israel continues its unrelenting attacks on Gaza. An Israeli strike on another school, this time the Mustafa Haffa School in Gaza City, killed at least 12 people Tuesday.
We were sitting peacefully and we did not see the explosion. The people are gone. They're dead. They are under the rubble. Our people. Our children. We don't know where our young girls. My dears, where are they?
Hundreds of people have taken shelter at the school. Displaced Palestinians are yet again on the move after Israel issued fresh evacuation orders for the densely packed Deir al-Balah. It's not clear where they can take refuge since there is no safe place in Gaza. In the southern city of Khan Yunis, a Palestinian man who spent over 2 months in Israel's Ofer prison was released and reunited with his family. Hab al-Din Makat recounted the horrors he and other Palestinian prisoners were subjected to.
We stayed for about 40 to 50 days blindfolded with this cloth. This way for 50 days. We were sitting down with our hands and feet bound. What's happening in the prison? There's no living person of conscience who could bear it.
The Palestinian Prisoners Society says detainees at Ofer prison suffer, quote, systematic torture and humiliation, unquote. This all comes as another ceasefire deal appears to have stalled. Meanwhile, Gaza's health ministry said Tuesday it's still waiting to receive polio vaccines amidst a growing risk of a major outbreak across Gaza. Lebanon's health ministry said at least 5 people were killed Tuesday in Israeli strikes in southern Lebanon. At least one other death was reported today. Hezbollah said it launched a barrage of rockets and drones at Israeli troops in response. A new report by Oil Change International lays out the countries and companies that have transferred the most fossil fuels to Israel since it's launched its war on Gaza and says they could be liable for complicity in war crimes and genocide under international law. Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, and Gabon are 3 of the top countries supplying crude oil to Israel. Brazil ranks in 4th place, supplying nearly 10% of Israel's crude, despite President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva speaking out against the war. U.S. supplies JPA jet fuel for Israel's warplanes sourced from a Valero refinery in Texas. Corporations including BP, Chevron, ExxonMobil, TotalEnergies, and Shell are also named as main culprits. The report holds up Colombia as an example for other nations after it halted coal exports to Israel over the war. In related news, the Scottish government announced it'll stop holding meetings with Israeli ambassadors until real progress is made towards a Gaza ceasefire. Russia says its air defenses shot down 11 Ukrainian drones in, quote, one of the largest ever attempts to attack Moscow with drones, unquote. This comes as Ukraine's surprise offensive in Russia's Kursk region continues. Kyiv says hundreds of Russian soldiers have surrendered since the incursion started 2 weeks ago. Meanwhile, Russian missile and drone attacks hit energy infrastructure in northern Ukraine, causing a large fire that released chlorine into the air from an industrial facility. Arizona's Supreme Court ruled voters will be able to decide whether abortion rights should be enshrined in Arizona's constitution in November's election. The ruling defeats an attempt by the group Arizona Right to Life to block the ballot measure. Also Tuesday, Montana's Secretary of State confirmed Montana's ballot will include an initiative on abortion rights. A total of 8 states now have abortion rights on the November ballot. A few others are still pending. In other election news, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s running mate has suggested the pair might end their independent bid for the White House and join forces with Donald Trump. Nicole Shanahan made the comment in an interview on the podcast Impact Theory.
There's two options that we're looking at, and one is staying in, forming that new party, but we run the risk of a Kamala Harris and Waltz presidency because we draw votes from Trump, or we draw somehow more votes from Trump, or we walk away right now and join forces with Donald Trump.
And back here in Chicago, just a few miles from the Democratic National Convention, over 1,000 nurses from the University of Illinois Hospital are on a week-long strike. The Illinois Nurses Association says UI Health has refused to address understaffing, unsafe working conditions, and fair pay demands. Democracy Now! Spoke to nurses on the picket line Tuesday.
Eileen Fajardo-Ferlin. I've been here at UIH since 2004, 20 years, and I also serve as the chair for the Nursing Care Committee. We're striking because of unfair labor practice. For the first time ever, the management team walked out during negotiation, walked out and wouldn't come back when we asked them to come back. But we do have other things that is on the table, one of which is our safety. They have a workplace violence prevention committee. There are 39 management people on the committee, not one single bedside nurse.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, peace, and the presidency. We're breaking with convention. When we come back, Secretary of State Blinken ends his visit to the Middle East without securing a breakthrough for a ceasefire deal. We'll get the latest and report on the Democratic National Convention. Stay with us.
I see you bragging about a birthright, bankrolled by my taxes, committing war crimes of the worst type, emboldened by some fascist leadership, too blind to see that these apartheid walls erected prevent us all from being free. So God bless the truth seekers, solidarity movements, journalists and academics being blacklisted for views that pose a threat to the establishment and its chokehold on the news. Though often feels we've lost already, there is still way too much to lose. Salvation, no matter how much you defend it. Dialogues without some patience or disagreements never ending. Religious men who are not humble only play themselves pretending. They alone have all these answers, mixing messages they're sending. Was it Ishmael or Isaac? Or does asking miss a point? Will it be Jesus or Elijah? Why would Allah disappoint? Look, if you know death is inevitable, then let nature take its course. No homicides, no suicides. We'll open heaven's gate by force. For what is life without a struggle? But a hollow shell of death.
God is love by Omar Effendi. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. We're broadcasting from the studios of CAN TV in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. The Israeli military has ordered new evacuation from areas in Deir al-Bala, signaling an expansion of Israel's ground operations in central Gaza. Deir al-Bala is the only remaining standing city in the entire Gaza Strip and is currently home to more than 1 million displaced Palestinians. An Israeli airstrike on a market in the city on Tuesday killed at least 7 people and wounded dozens more. At least 50 Palestinians have been killed in the last 24 hours, according to the health ministry in Gaza. On Tuesday, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken ended his 9th visit to the Middle East since October without securing any breakthrough for a ceasefire deal. Blinken has said that Israel has accepted a so-called bridging proposal put forward by the U.S. and now the focus should be on Hamas to, quote, get on board as soon as possible. But few details have been released about what is in the bridging proposal, and Hamas has called it a reversal of what it had previously agreed to, accusing the U.S. of acquiescing to new conditions from Israel. Over 40,200 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's assault on Gaza, and nearly 93,000 wounded since October.
Here in Chicago, Gaza has hardly been mentioned by top Democrats speaking on the main stage at the DNC this week. On Monday, the Democratic National Convention voted to adopt the party's official platform, that's the Democratic National Committee, which does not call for an arms embargo on Israel and reasserts unwavering U.S. support for Israel. President Biden gave a 50-minute address on the opening night of the convention. This is all he had to say about the war on Gaza.
We're working around the clock, my Secretary of State, to prevent a wider war and reunite hostages with their families and surge humanitarian health and food assistance into Gaza now. To end the civilian suffering of the Palestinian people and finally deliver a ceasefire and end this war. Those protesters out in the street, they have a point. A lot of innocent people are being killed on both sides.
For more, we're joined by Zaha Hassan, a human rights lawyer, a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She was previously the senior legal advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team during Palestine's bid for UN membership. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Zaha. We want to talk about what the Democrats are saying about Gaza now and, you know, back to Obama, Clinton. But let's start with the latest news. Antony Blinken has just finished his trip, did not secure a ceasefire. Explain what's taken place.
Well, you said in your opening remarks that, you know, Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, said he had a bridging proposal, right? That this was supposed to get us to a ceasefire and that all we needed was Hamas to agree. The bridge apparently is a bridge to nowhere because a deal was struck in May 31st, and that was supposed to be a deal that Israel wanted and that the U.S. supported. Hamas agreed to it. And what we have now is a new agreement that's being called an implementing agreement, but we don't have the details. But what we do know is that Israel has said it's not after a permanent ceasefire, and it's not intending to leave the Philadelphia corridor, which is along the border between Egypt and Gaza. These are non-starters for Hamas, and the Israeli security officials that are involved in the negotiations know that. And they're baffled by this notion that, you know, according to the U.S. position, that we're closer than we ever were, because they know that these aren't positions that Hamas is going to agree to. Hamas has their concerns. They want to be able to stay in Gaza. They want to make sure that they have achieved something after all the destruction and all of the death. And for them, the achievement would be being able to pick the hostages or the prisoners that are they want released. And it would be being able to stay in Gaza and being able to rebuild and show Palestinians that they've achieved something and they've made Israel concede something. And that's not what's happening in this latest rendition of an agreement.
Well, even the New York Times today is reporting that, according to some of the people close to the negotiations, that the U.S. has changed the original proposal that Biden said had been agreed to please some of the concerns of Israel. I'm wondering, this whole thing of constantly saying we're almost there, while more and more people are being killed every day, what that does to the credibility of the United States before the world community.
No, it's completely shattered at this point, because we all know what it's going to take to get across the finish line in terms of an agreement. We have Qatar and Egypt putting all pressure on Hamas. Hamas is reliant on Egypt for that border that it needs to have some kind of movement and access. And Qatar has Hamas officials, and it can force them out of its country. So there's a lot of pressure on Hamas' side. On the Israeli side, you have zero pressure from the U.S. There is no willingness to use any pressure on Israel to get to an agreement. We know that the families of the hostages, the Israeli hostages, they've beseeched the U.S. to please use your leverage on Israel, because they know that their prime minister has no incentive to conclude a deal.
So instead, it was announced last week that the Biden administration and Congress have approved $20 billion more in military sales before this final negotiation, as opposed to holding out as a carrot to Netanyahu after.
So, yes, exactly. What's the message then to Netanyahu that he can continue to hold out, hold his position, avoid accountability for his failure of leadership for October 7th, avoid corruption charges that are awaiting him, and stay in office and maintain his coalition, and he'll still get benefits from the U.S.
I'm wondering, last night's convention, even Bernie Sanders, who has spoken out in the past, he did mention that we must have an immediate ceasefire, but even he did mention all that is needed for that ceasefire is for the U.S. to cut off arms supplies to Israel. That would be the real leverage that the United States has.
You're right. I mean, there could have been a lot more said by a lot of different people that took them to the main stage last night and the night before. You know, saying that we're working for a ceasefire or that we're calling for a ceasefire is not what's needed. But, you know, these conventions are, you know, heavily managed stagecraft, and everyone wants to have, you know, sort of a uniting voice and a uniting spirit in this convention setting, given how, you know, how much is riding on this next election, given what might happen in November with a Republican return with Donald Trump at the helm. So there is this idea that, you know, we don't want to show too much disunity. So I think that there has been a much more muted references to Gaza in this convention, which is unfortunate, because if you go to the streets and you see the thousands that have shown up here in Chicago to demand people from all walks of life, diverse backgrounds, coming to say, no, this is an important issue to us, and it should matter to the Democrats, given the battleground states and how close things are going to be.
You know, it's interesting. Every time there's even a passing reference to Gaza or to Israel-Palestine from the main stage, there is deafening applause. When Raphael Warnock, the senator from Georgia, the reverend, mentioned at the end, you know, that Palestinians, Israelis, Ukrainians are all children of God. I mean, deafening applause right through to last night. And these are passing references. Zaha Hassan, you have written in 972 magazine about U.S. policy, and particularly Democratic policy, over the years, from Clinton to Obama, to what we're seeing now. And last night was the big night of the Obamas on the stage. Both Michelle Obama spoke and President Obama. Can you talk about the trajectory and whether it is significantly or meaningfully different from Republican policy on Gaza, Israel, Palestine?
No, in fact, I think there's been an almost competition between Democrats and Republicans on how much can we show Israel that we support them and that we have their back. And so what we had in terms of the U.S. position on negotiations is that each administration has tried to diminish the Palestinian negotiating position in order to gain support from Israel for, domestically in the U.S., to show that this administration, whether Republican or Democrat, is the true friend of Israel. And in the process, it's prevented really a resolution between Palestinians and Israelis. Why should Israel ever compromise its positions if they know that by holding out, they'll get more goodies from the U.S. in terms of changing the parameters for a peace agreement? And so this sort of dynamic, we're also seeing it play out in terms of the ceasefire negotiations. The U.S. is unwilling to offer any leverage to press Israel, and in fact is offering it goodies in terms of more weapons supplies and more diplomatic cover at the U.N. and other fora. And this just prevents getting to an agreement.
I want to ask you about something related. You posted on social media recently about Israel's targeting of a Palestinian journalist in Gaza who was working on a short documentary for Carnegie, where you are a fellow. Well, what happened there?
So, you know, we had this short documentary. We wanted to, you know, shed light on sort of how dangerous it has been for Palestinian journalists to cover the situation in Gaza. Foreign journalists are not allowed in. So while these Palestinian journalists are covering, they're also trying to stay alive. They're trying to take care of their families. They're facing evacuation orders. They're being targeted. And so we wanted to just, in a very brief way, show what life is like every day for the journalists trying to cover. And during the course of this short documentary, the journalist that was offering a narration got targeted, and he lost his leg.
I want to play two clips for you. At the DNC last night, Democracy Now!'s Renee Feltz briefly spoke to Maryland Congressmember Jamie Raskin, who has supported a Gaza ceasefire.
Representative Raskin, what did you think of the protests last night?
I was up there, so I didn't see the protests.
And they unfurled a banner, you know, they're asking for a ceasefire.
Well, I thought that President Biden made a very powerful statement in his speech. But right now, I think the vast majority of the people in this room want to see the hostages come home, a ceasefire, and a comprehensive agreement that will break the cycle of terrorism, war, and occupation. And I think everybody wants to get out of it as quickly as possible. Thank you.
That was Democratic Congressmember Jamie Raskin of Maryland. Democracy Now! Also spoke to Rima Mohammed, an uncommitted delegate from Michigan.
I'm Palestinian. Both my grandparents were Nakba survivors of 1948. I have family still in Israel, so they're in Aqaba. They're feeling traumatized as this goes on. I also have close family friends that have lost hundreds of their family members. So this is very personal to me. But also, as this keeps going on, it is impacting my life and a lot of other Muslim and Palestinians here in the U.S. with an increase in anti-Palestinian racism, Islamophobia, and so much hate for something that we're asking for humanity. We're not asking for anything more but just a respect. So that's why this is how this is impacting me personally. Regardless of who the Democratic nominee is, you know, or who even the president is, been living that throughout my life, but it has increased since Gaza, since the genocide that's happening in Gaza is going on. So it's a little bit dehumanizing, to be honest, for me to have to be all that weight to be on my shoulder as a Palestinian that is facing racism, facing hate, to then say, well, wait, why? Who are you going to choose between Trump and Biden? I want to choose true democracy. I'm a true Democrat, but I also don't believe what we're doing in Gaza is democratic.
Again, that was Rima Mohammed, an uncommitted delegate from Michigan who is Palestinian-American. Your thoughts, Zaha Hassan, as, you know, we hear last night was the virtual roll call vote. They'd already taken it virtually, but actually it was the ceremonial one on the floor. And you would hear in certain states those that had not committed to Harris walls, though it wasn't talked about in that way. I assume that the vast majority of them had to do with being uncommitted, like Rima.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was on the floor yesterday and the day before, and I'm coming across the uncommitted voters. I'm coming across just plain old Democrats that are really hungry to hear some kind of policy difference between Biden's approach and what a prospective President Harris's approach would be, and they're not hearing it. We know from a YouGov poll that was recently done by the Institute for Middle East Understanding that between like 34% and over 40% of the independent and Democrats that were polled say that if the Democratic nominee would say that they would have an arms embargo on Israel, or if they would be able to deliver a ceasefire, that if Biden was able to deliver a ceasefire, that they would be more likely to support the Democratic nominee. I mean, this should be, you know, a clarion call for the Harris campaign. They should be willing to come out and offer a vision of what a Harris presidency would look like. They should be putting pressure on the president himself to do something before November 4th. But you don't see this urgency. What you're seeing you know, in this heavily managed convention is an effort to avoid talking about Gaza at all. And this is problematic if you want to win in November.
We want to thank you for being with us, Zaha Hassan, human rights lawyer, fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, previously the senior legal advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team during Palestine's bid for UN membership. Democracy Now! Has expanded to 2 hours during this week, broadcasting from Chicago from the Democratic National Convention. In our other hour, we will speak with a Congress member who was targeted by AIPAC and ultimately lost his seat. He is Andy Levin of Michigan. He was a synagogue president. We'll also be hearing from doctors who've just returned from Gaza, American doctors who came to the DNC to speak about their experiences. But coming up, immigration is one of the biggest issues of this year's race. We'll host a roundtable discussion. Stay with us.
Sigo cruzando ríos, andando selvas, amando el sol. Cada día sigo sacando espinas de lo profundo del corazón. En la noche sigo encendiendo sueños para limpiar con el humo sagrado cada recuerdo. Cuando escriba tu nombre en la arena blanca con fondo azul, cuando mire cielo en la forma cruel de una nube gris, aparezcas tú. Una tarde subo una alta loma, mire el pasado, sabrás que no te he olvidado. Yo te llevo dentro hasta la raíz, y por más que creas,
La Raíz, To the Root, by Natalia Lafourcade. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. We're breaking with convention. I'm Amy Goodman here in Chicago with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to look at immigration, which is shaping up to be one of the biggest issues of the 2024 race. On the campaign trail, Republican nominee Donald Trump has repeatedly vowed to deport over 10 million immigrants. At the Republican National Convention last month, Trump falsely claimed there was an invasion at the U.S.-Mexico border.
The greatest invasion in history is taking place right here in our country. They are coming in from every corner of the earth, not just from South America, but from Africa, Asia, the Middle East. They're coming from everywhere. They're coming at levels that we've never seen before. It is an invasion indeed, and this administration does absolutely nothing to stop them. That's why, to keep our families safe, the Republican platform promises to launch the largest deportation operation in the history of our country.
Meanwhile, here at the Democratic National Convention, President Biden hailed his executive action to block migrants from seeking asylum at the southern border.
The result of the executive action I took, border encounters have dropped over 50%. In fact, there are fewer border crossings today than when Donald Trump left office. And unlike Trump, we will not demonize immigrants, saying they're the poison, the blood of America. poison the blood of our country. Kamala and I are committed to strengthening legal immigration, including protecting dreamers and more.
Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris vowed in a recent campaign ad to hire thousands of more border agents.
Kamala Harris has spent decades fighting violent crime. As a border state prosecutor, she took on drug cartels and jailed gang members for smuggling weapons and drugs across the border. As vice president, she backed the toughest border control bill in decades. And as president, she will hire thousands more border agents and crack down on fentanyl and human trafficking. Fixing the border is tough. So is Kamala Harris.
I'm Kamala Harris, and I approve this message.
To talk more about immigration and the presidential race, we're joined by three guests. Oscar Chacon is executive director of Alianza Americas, an immigrant rights group based here in Chicago. Maria Hinojosa is joining us, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and founder of Futuro Media. She's the host of Latino USA. And Marissa Franco is with us, director and co-founder of Mi Gente, a national digital organizing hub for Latinx and Chicanx communities. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Marissa, we're going to begin with you because last night on the stage, one of the Republican border mayors endorsed Vice President Harris for the presidency, crossing parties. You are from Arizona. You're usually based in Phoenix. If you can talk about the significance of this and why Republicans are joining Democrats and saying the Democratic platform, which is often adopting the Republican platform, is what they are satisfied with now.
I mean, I think that what we can understand that is that the coalition that was formed in 2020 that spans from progressives to folks who are part of the Republican Party, our unity is based off of what we're against, which is a second term for Donald Trump. But I think the reason we're here is because we understand we need to be on the outside, continuing to push, but also contest space for the inside and like what's happening inside of the party. And because at the end of the day, this coalition's unity ends after Election Day. And so we have to be prepared to be able to advocate and push. And so while we're part of this big tent, how are we pushing forward the issues we want to see change on? How are we building our ranks, our base? And how are we ascending the types of leaders that are going to advance the policies that we want to see enacted?
And when you hear a Donald Trump talking about vowing to deport 10 million immigrants from the United States if he's elected president, what is your perspective and viewpoint, even about the possibility of such a measure?
It's a political stunt. And as usual, Donald Trump is talking out of both sides of his mouth. Just the fact that the Democrats are going to push a disastrous border bill that we were all against. And he was the person that stopped it. He told the Republicans to stop it. Why? Because it's politically convenient for them to continue to have this issue to be able to campaign on. And so to me, I think there's also, it's incumbent for the Democrats, the correct way to engage on this issue is not to adopt the policies or the rhetoric of Donald Trump. And so, you know, Donald Trump is going to continue to use this issue because they don't want to talk about the real issues. The issues aren't that immigrants are coming to this country for a better life. It's the continued billionaires are the problem, not immigrants seeking a better life. And they don't want to have that conversation. And I think that's the conversation the Democrats should not run from.
And Oscar, I wanted to ask you, there's been a lot of attention placed on the how the Latino vote in this election will play out. We have about 7.7 million people who have passed the age of 18 and are now eligible to vote since the last election in 2020. And 53% of them, about 3.9 million, are Hispanic youth. Your sense of how young people, especially young Hispanics, are approaching this coming election?
Well, first of all, I think that it's important to remember there are millions of voters of Latin American origin. I mean, I like to say that because sometimes when we say the Latino vote, inadvertently we're suggesting some level of, you know, homogeneity within that universe, which is not really true. With that said, I think younger voters are more likely to be supportive of overall more progressive stance, no matter what issue you pick, including immigration. However, I mean, also it is important to remember there are many people seduced, you know, by some of the arguments raised by Donald Trump and other Republicans, simply because we are part of a nation that has forever and ever praised, you know, wealth, praised the notion that a powerful white man that sells himself as a successful businessman is a model to follow. I mean, and that is a problem that every community has to tackle in order to aspire to a behavior when it comes to voting that is more consistent with what really makes a positive difference in the life of communities, including communities of Latin American origin.
Maria Hinojosa, I want to have you respond to Senator Mark Kelly. At the DNC last night, Democracy Now! Producer Maria Teresena spoke to Arizona Senator Mark Kelly. And let's remember how significant he is, because he was clearly one of the last candidates, along with Walz and Shapiro, to be the VP pick for Vice President Harris. This is what Senator Kelly had to say.
You were in the run to be vice president in candidate Harris's ticket. Now you've come in support of Harris, of course, for 2024. She's been very critical at times of Trump's sabotage of the Senate border bill that did not pass.
As she should be.
Some say that she might be alienating some voters as she tries to portray herself as tougher on border security than Trump. Do you think that's a good strategy? And do you agree with that argument that she might be alienating voters who want something different than Trump's tragedy on the border and immigration?
I don't think so. As a senator from a border state, border security is important. It's not good for migrants to have chaos at the border. You know, it just isn't. I mean, this is a desert. It's a, you know, hazardous environment. We need an orderly process at the border. Kamala Harris gets that. Donald Trump doesn't get it. We had a border security bill that was bipartisan. It was going to do some really positive things, including reuniting families. You know, Kamala Harris supported that legislation. Donald Trump didn't. And what that legislation would have done if we would have gotten it passed, it would have allowed us to then work on comprehensive immigration reform. You know, what I would, you know, at the top of my list for immigration reform is to have a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers. Dreamers are as American as my own two kids. You know, one was born in Maryland, one was in Texas. Dreamers deserve this. And there's so many other things we can do that would also strengthen our economy. You know, other visa programs. But border security is, you know, important for people who live in Arizona. And Kamala Harris gets this. Donald Trump just wants to use this issue to try to win an election.
So that's Arizona Senator Mark Kelly. If you can respond to what he says, but then overall, what you think the issues are that should be being addressed here and what is being addressed?
The chaos, there is no chaos on the border. I just need to say there is a humanitarian crisis, but the chaos was created by the policies initially of Donald Trump. So let's just put that true. I just think it's important that we change the narrative entirely. He's right. What we should be talking about right now is comprehensive immigration reform, comprehensive, and a pathway to citizenship. In that sense, he's right. If I was giving counsel to Kamala Harris, what I would say is you need to have a primetime address on the issue of immigration. And you need to come to the camera and say, unequivocally, we are stopping this narrative about immigrants and refugees as a problem, as bringing in crime, as affecting our economy in a negative way. She needs to make a statement based in reality, right? Which is stop with this notion of the border as a place where people are coming in and nobody knows. She needs to take the moment because she can, because she's the daughter of immigrants. There's nobody who can better do it than her. Mm-hmm. Also, Joe Biden's parting gift. I know people think I'm like out of this, you know, when I say this. Joe Biden's parting gift needs to be actually for him to say, executive order, pathway to citizenship. Now, Why not? What is stopping him? I mean, even the Supreme Court has said that a president is not liable. He's not breaking the law. He will actually, if he does that, he will guarantee, I'm saying this and I don't like to make these predictions, if they do that, Kamala will win. Because all of those immigrants who are questioning her position when she's like, we want to be tough on the border, et cetera, they would say, oh my God, this is in fact our party, this is in fact our candidate, and they could win. I think it would be a game changer, and it needs to stop this narrative about criminals and immigrants and breaking laws. That is not who we are. And you have to talk to people who have actually been to the border, like Marisa, like myself, like Oscar, to understand that that narrative is not true.
And Maria, when you talk about changing the narrative, this whole emphasis on immigration and crime is really a modern version, isn't it, of the Willie Horton approach to finding an other to rally the right-wing populace around? Because the reality is that crime rates among immigrants are far lower than they are among U.S.-born citizens.
Hence why when Kamala Harris does her primetime address on this issue, she actually goes really nerdy and has a whiteboard and says, let me show you, so it is unequivocal, that the FBI has said that over the last 30 years, violent crime has dropped precipitously. Let me show you on my little whiteboard that the cities where immigrants are arriving to are among the safest, New York City, for example. Now, when you take a people like vulnerable migrants and refugees and you have them, like in New York City, what's happening now, you put them into Roosevelt Hotel, then you're taking them out, then you're leaving them on the streets, and then you're moving them around, and then you're having them encampments. This is a recipe for disaster. New York should be, I'm just saying New York because that's where I live, should be doing a much better job. Because sadly, that reality is going to create a very ugly, visible situation. Where you're going to have migrants and refugees sleeping on the streets of New York, which is happening now, that is unacceptable. But then again, the mayor of New York needs to do something. Point is, massive change of narrative that only Kamala Harris can do.
And Marisa, I wanted to ask you, in terms of what you would hope, what you think Kamala Harris needs to do to set herself apart from the previous policies of the Biden administration, the Trump administration, and even the Obama administration to some degree.
I think that, one of the tenets of her campaign is freedom, and specifically talking about reproductive freedom, reproductive justice, and inside of that is bodily autonomy. And I think there's not that far to understand the freedom to migrate and the freedom to move and the freedom to pursue a better life. So when we're talking about immigration, I think there's a recognition for that, and to be able to resist the sort of political ploys of the Republican Party, but then also resist the lack of political courage that the Democrats have shown. There is executive orders, there's pushing what we can push through Congress, but there's also standing up to the likes of Governor Abbott in the state of Texas, who has taken the mantle that was, you know, very much in my home state of Arizona, and standing up to Greg Abbott and the things that he's doing and that he continues to do, and standing with Mayor Johnson here in Chicago, who has been receiving folks coming and you know, different mayors across the country, and being able to actually push forward at the municipal level policies around immigration that I think we have had comprehensive immigration reform. It's just been all enforcement. Mm-hmm. And so we need to really turn towards the course of legalization. I think also other key issues, the question of care and how much she's been a champion on that, labor, healthcare, education. Like, these are all things that I think people would really support in finding, the sweet spot between policies that are possible but impactful in our communities, I think, is what people are looking for. I think voters are looking for who cares about me, who cares about my future. And I think those types of things are things that people would really respond to.
Can I add something?
Go ahead, Maria.
Okay, I know it's going to sound a little performative, but again, if I was running the campaign, what I would do is I would make sure that they right now start dropping jingles for Latinos, reggaeton jingle, cumbia jingle, merengue jingle, salsa jingle, that are being broadcast everywhere, that actually say everything that you just said, Marisa, but it's in a jingle, and that people are now repeating it and dancing it everywhere. I'm telling you, I know it's performative, But I think that they need to show, like, okay, we understand that you're not a block. You come from all of these different places. We're going to get down with that.
I want to go to the Obamas because last night they owned the stage. Let's go to the former president, Barack Obama, who spoke last night on the main stage at the DNC.
They understand that we can secure our borders without tearing kids away from their parents. Just like we can keep our streets safe while also building trust between law enforcement and the communities they serve and eliminating bias, that will make it better for everybody.
So that was President Obama last night. But when he actually was president, he became known as, dubbed by his Latino allies. To his shock, I remember the moment someone asked him, what do you think of being called the deporter in chief? And he said, they're saying that? Oscar Chacon, you're with Alianza Americas. Talk about what President Obama said last night and what he actually implemented as immigration policy.
Well, they always say the presidents tend to say what they should have said and done when they were presidents, which is not always the case. But let me just say that, in my opinion, the problem with not only Biden or Obama is that literally going back 35 years, the Democratic Party made a conscious choice to basically do not defy the dominant narrative put forward by extremists, you know, racist, xenophobic forces, which are now fully, you know, in control within the Republican Party. And that basic narrative that paints today's immigrants as a threat, as a cancer to the nation, sadly has not been really confronted. I mean, a lot of what we are talking about here would imply that for a new horizon to be put forward, you have to begin with setting the record straight, saying plainly that the attacks against immigrants today are essentially lies. There is no substance to what they are saying. So we need policies and we need jingles, of course, I agree. But they need to be anyways based on truth. They need to be based on evidence. I say it all the time. You know, immigrants and immigration are a true blessing to the country in every way you want to look at it. And they're also a blessing, you know, for millions of households in Mexico, Central America, South America, the Caribbean, when you look at the amount of money the hardworking immigrants send back to their countries of origin, to their relatives. So again, we need a policy that, yes, just as Marisa said, is harmoniously combined between a reasonable, truth-based immigration policy, but also combined with policies that clearly show that a government in the United States of America is truly committed to advancing the well-being of everyone without any exclusion. I can tell you that a lot of what Obama said yesterday is fully applicable, not only to the U.S., but also to many countries that are neighbors of ours. What are we really doing to fix that so that we can once and for all begin to tackle the actual so-called root causes of migration?
And Maria, I wanted to ask you, in terms of this narrative and the work that Latinos do in this country, immigrants especially, here in Chicago, 70% of all the landscapers in the city of Chicago are Mexican, half of all the restaurant workers. And you could go on all of the low-paid work that is done here by migrants that have helped to revive some of these cities. And yet the narrative is always about the criminality and those who are who are bringing problems and seeking to use government resources.
So what I say is open your eyes, which, again, Kamala should be saying. Enough with what you hear. Actually open your eyes and see the immigrants all around you and be like, huh, oh, this one's working at 4 o'clock in the morning doing this or that. Also, I like to remember, and it's important that Oscar is a professional. Marisa is a professional. I'm a professional. We're all immigrants. My father helped to create the cochlear implant here at the University of Chicago, steps away from where we are. So yes, we are all of those things, Juan. We are the laborers, but we're also the brains behind this country. So That has to be so important because, you know, Juan and I, we've been around so long that I know I say, how is it possible that our black brothers and sisters and that our fellow Latino and Latina, Latinx and Latine immigrants, sons and daughters of immigrants are buying into these lies? Mm-hmm. How is it possible? It truly is brilliant in the sense of mis and disinformation. But what we have to do is to then replace that with every single one who's listening and watching this. When people say, oh, I don't know what to do. You know what you do? You go and tell the next person that you see, hey, do you see that immigrant doing this job? Do you see the immigrant doing this job? Do you know about my immigrant neighbor? It has to be person to person and just an onslaught of these other messages to combat what we've had to deal with over the last several decades.
I mean, after all, Trump is absolutely correct. Say a lie 1,000 times, people believe it. And that's exactly what they've done. I mean, the only reason immigration is such a hot topic is not because it's real. It's being manufactured by lies.
There is something, I think, also just to name it, we're talking a lot about immigration and Latinos. This is a really important moment for black Americans. I mean, the possibility of a black woman president, I think, is significant. And I think there's really important things that Michelle Obama actually talked about yesterday that I think actually speak and relate to immigrant people, people of color, people who don't come from money, the do something. So, like, changing the narrative. A lot of us did not have the privilege of being able to fail forward as, like, the likes of Donald Trump. And so I think there's a piece there that, because there is real, we have to come out of this with a stronger coalition of communities of color and low-income communities. And I think that there is real jewels in some of the narrative that she was putting out that connects deeply to values that are commonly held across communities. So I really wanted to lift that up and also recognize how important of a moment that is, mm-hmm. and how beautiful it is to see the community mobilizing behind her and how much it's transformed the campaign. I can say that in Arizona and some of the different states we work in, it is truly shifting at the ground level.
And we only have about a minute, but what is Mi Gente planning to do from now until Election Day? You haven't endorsed anyone yet. You did endorse Bernie Sanders in the primaries in 2020. What do you see as your work after this convention?
We are doing a national tour of over 20 cities called El Chisme that's broadening the frame beyond the top of the ticket and looking at the local levels. We're having an event. Maria is joining us tonight here in Chicago. We're mobilizing voters in four states in Texas, Arizona, North Carolina, and Georgia. And we're preparing to hit the ground running in 2025. Pase lo que pase, whoever ends up winning. We got to keep organizing.
You helped Biden win Arizona, turning it blue. You haven't made an endorsement this time.
We did not. I think we're prepared to mobilize, but we don't endorse every time. And for us, you know, our members were not, we were not going to endorse Biden. And when it shifted, we were a little bit too far in the game. So we're mobilizing, but we did not endorse.
But Maria, in New York, Make the Road did endorse Vice President Harris to be president.
That's why I'm saying this is a particularly fascinating moment. And you have progressive organizations like Make the Road endorsing, others still waiting. But this is why I'm so glad, Marisa, that you brought up the importance of the black Latino. Also, there are Afro-Latinos. There are so many black Latinos. That question, like, will Latinos vote for a black man or vote for a black woman in this case? Yes. And we have to. It's a historical moment. You know, I'm a kid, a Mexican kid who grew up here on the south side of Chicago. My mom, who's 88 now, made the decision of, well, we're Mexican immigrants, but we are siding with Martin Luther King. That is our guy. So that notion of the solidarity between black and Latino communities must exist.
We have to leave it there, but I want to thank you for being with us. And, of course, we'll continue this discussion. Maria Hinojosa, head of Futuro Media, Oscar Chacon with Alianza Americas, and Marisa Franco, director and co-founder of Mi Gente. That does it for this hour. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago.